failed to intimidate. Leaning forward again, I pulled up the search bar and typed in Noctisoma. Now that I finally had a name, perhaps the internet might offer more information. A few medical studies popped up through Medscape, but when I clicked, it only offered a brief synopsis, nothing in-depth or accessible to me without the proper login credentials. I pulled up the CDC website and typed the parasite there. Only a data report for a Geneva conference had listed it amongst pages and pages of other parasites. There was literally nothing. To be thorough, I typed in Black Worms and Dracadia University. The first article to populate the screen was from a Dracadian Gazette, dated only a few weeks ago, whose headline read,
"Homeless woman assaults provost with intent to kill."
It went on to describe a woman believed to be named Andrea Kepling, who'd been living in one of the abandoned houses on the island and had broken into the home of a Dr. Lippincott, the provost of Dracadia University. Armed with a pickaxe, she'd accused him of putting worms in her belly, according to Lippincott's wife, who'd witnessed the attack. I paused there. At the peak of my mother's illness, she'd accused me of putting something inside of her, too, infecting her intentionally. Those had been the times when her eyes had turned spacey, her pupils blown. They'd been the times she'd looked positively feral enough to kill me. I couldn't imagine having someone break into my home in that state, with a pickaxe, no less. Apparently, the woman had managed to wound Lippincott's leg, but escaped before authorities arrived. The Associated Police sketch of Andrea didn't look like a criminal, though. In some ways, she reminded me of my mother, with her long hair and weary eyes. At a knock on the door, I groaned and closed my laptop. "I'm studying."
"Just need to chat for a second,"
Connor's muffled voice said from the other side of the door. "Fine. A second." He cracked the door open and peeked inside before stepping into the room.
Hey.
Rubbing his hands together, he cleared his throat.
"I know that things have been pretty hard for you lately. And, you know, you could have left a long time ago. But you hung around here and helped with B, and I know you didn't have to do that."
I didn't like where this might be going. Connor rarely acknowledged my contributions. If anything, he often criticized me for turning down extra shifts at the hospital, shifts I'd reluctantly turned down to get some studying in.
"I want to make things easier on you."
Definitely didn't like where that might be going. That wasn't Connor. Connor was a blue collar who'd lectured me at 16 years old that nothing in life was free. Something was amiss. Okay.
"We've talked about this before."
The moment his hand raised to rub the back of his neck and his gaze fell from mine, I knew exactly what he was going to say, and I breathed a sigh. "I know. You want to rent out Mom's old room." I suppose it was out of respect for me and B that he hadn't yet, and I had appreciated that for a number of years. Struggling for the sake of her memory didn't make sense, though. It had been long enough. "It's fine."
"You're sure, kid? I mean, you know, I could wait a little bit longer."
"No," I said, waving my hand dismissively. "We need the money." In the pause that followed, I glanced up to see him picking at his fingers, seemingly anxious. Maybe he'd been nervous to ask me about the room. I was nervous, too. "Can I ask you something?"
"Yeah, shoot."
"Remember after my mom died, I told you about...
the worms, yeah, I remember."
Brows furrowed, he lowered his gaze.
I don't blame you, kid. That was a pretty rough scene with your mom bleeding out everywhere."
"You're sure you didn't see anything in the tub?" I'd always found it strange how vividly that visual remained in my head for something that hadn't actually happened.
"Why are you asking me this?"
An air of suspicion bled through his voice.
"You read the coroner's reports, Lil. The autopsy. Multiple times. It's all there."
Sighing, I slouched back in my chair. I had... but Professor Wilkins had also said that not all physicians were aware of the organism as a human pathogen. Perhaps they'd missed it in autopsy. "I know. I just thought maybe you'd seen something else."
"Everything I saw is detailed in that report,"
he said.
"You okay?"
"Yeah. I'm fine. I just miss her." There was no point in arguing with him. He supposedly hadn't seen what I'd seen. Maybe the blood had darkened the water too much. Maybe all of the worms had gotten down the drain somehow.
"Yeah."
He let out a long exhale and cleared his throat.
So, what would you say if I asked Angelo to come stay here?
A turbulent dread curled through my stomach as my mood quickly shifted, and I shook my head. You're not serious, are you?
I just figured he's over here all the time, and he's living in that shithole down on Sumla.
No, no, come on, Connor, seriously?
He's my best friend, Lilia.
He ran his hands through his hair, the stress etched into his expression more apparent to me in that moment. Fingers clutching the pillows around me, I stifled the urge to throw something across the room at him. The guy's a creep, Connor. You know he cornered me the last time he was here and basically threatened to kill me. With a dismissive wave, he shook his head.
Nah, he wouldn't do that. He's just a dick is all.
That is not a dick. That's a goddamn predator. Hands splayed to the side, he shrugged.
The fuck do you want me to do, Lilia, huh?
Tell him hell no. That's what I want. He's a freak.
Who could help with the fucking bills? I'm drowning here.
I'm not opposed to a roommate, but not Angelo. Please, I still have to live here and work.
And I work too.
The way he thumped his finger into his chest gave off the caveman vibes I loathed.
I work, and this fucking apartment is in my name, so I get to say who lives here.
The one thing that I wish my mother would have thought through a bit more before her death. Not that she'd had a lot of choices. I'd only been 16 at the time, and certainly couldn't have had the apartment in my name. But adding Connor had made for some really tense and frustrating situations.
It'd be a fuck of a lot easier around here,
he said. And what happens when Bea comes home for the holidays? You really want her around him? You think that's good for her mental health?
Bea is fine. She doesn't need a fucking quack school and therapists. She needs friends. A life.
The rage exploded inside of me, and I shot to my feet, hands balled to tight fists at my sides. She has a life. And friends. She's doing better because she's finally getting the help she needs. Someone is finally listening to her, and now you want to destroy that by inviting Angelo the Creep over for slumber parties? He's a loser, Connor. You need to ditch him before he gets us wrapped up in something dangerous.
He saved my fucking life.
Not that I'd been present for that, of course. But apparently some guy they'd gone to see a while back had pulled a gun on the two of them. It just so happened that Angelo had been quicker on the draw.
God damn. You bust my balls like your mom.
Fuck you, Connor. Fuck you. You never deserved my mother.
Yeah? None of you ungrateful shits deserve me. So fuck you, Lilia.
He slammed the door on exiting, rattling my mom's painting off the wall, pissing me off even more. The rims of my eyes burned with the threat of tears. Don't break. Angry heat rose in my cheeks, and I ground my teeth, wishing I could have blinked myself somewhere else. Somewhere far away, like the tree and the swing and the open sea. I plopped down on my bed and cradled my face in my palms. Do not break. I couldn't live in the same place as Angelo. I couldn't. What little sanctuary I'd made of the apartment would be torn to shit by his presence. Hopefully Connor would come to his senses about it. Otherwise, I'd have to make arrangements to have Bea stay at the dorms for the holidays. I'd make a point to visit her on Christmas, still a few months away. It wasn't like we'd had wonderful Christmases at the apartment anyway, since Mom had died. It had mostly been Bea and I sitting in our bedroom playing Mom's old Beatles records and drinking too much hot chocolate. Technically, we could have done that anywhere. As for me, I needed to find a way to pay at least 2 months of Bea's tuition up front. If I could do that, then maybe, just maybe, leaving this place wouldn't be so impossible. Ever consider, like, an OnlyFans or something? Jada peeled off a white sheet that bore an enormous yellow stain. Still scrubbing at dried piss that had somehow dribbled over the bed's rails, I shook my head. Definitely not. Nothing against those who posted there. Hell, if I had the guts, I might have actually considered it. I didn't, though. I can tell you, I've thought about it a few times myself. Shit. Be a whole lot better than grabbing up bedsheets, praying not to get stabbed by a dirty needle. She tossed the wadded-up ball of sheets into a soiled linen bag. A friend of my cousin's did it. Was making a couple grand a month before she found herself a sugar daddy. Now her lazy ass sits by a pool all day long reading romance novels. I didn't know why I chuckled in response. Probably just needed something to laugh about after the conversation with Connor. This is your chance, Lilia. The Lord put you on a path that you did not see coming, and you need to walk it. Sighing, I paused scrubbing the piss and tried to imagine myself walking the halls of an Ivy League university. I know, but nothing. You took care of your mama. Now you're taking care of your sister and her daddy. You're done. The Lord is telling you it's time for you now. Even though I wasn't all that religious, I didn't mind Jada's Lord talk. I'd have loved to believe that all this turmoil actually meant something. Why didn't you become a preacher, if you're so up on what the Lord has planned? Because I like fucking too much, she said, rubbing her hand over her rounded belly. And Lord knows his daddy is good at it, so he didn't put me on that path. Back to my scrubbing, I huffed. Can I just come live with you and Quentin? You know you can. You're always welcome. But that's not what you really want. You want to be some Harry Potter bitch living it up with all those pretentious rich white folk, and don't tell me you don't. I snorted and shook my head. Actually, the thought of living with them kind of scares me. I don't know that life. Covington is my home. They don't matter. What matters is your dream. You deserve to be wearing a lab coat, not some nasty, shit-stained scrubs. Well, posting videos of myself on OnlyFans isn't going to be good for my reputation. Why not? She set her hands on her hips. Why the fuck not? Some girls strip to get themselves through med school. You do what you gotta do, Lilia. Brow raised, she pointed a finger at me like a mother chiding a kid. Don't let nobody shame you. Why do you always have to be so... right? Positive is the word I was going for. Because I'll be damned if I'm sitting here scrubbing floors and trash with you next year, when you have a full-ride scholarship waiting on you like that. Go, figure the rest out later. What if I did? My mother had always been spontaneous like that, always throwing caution to the wind. She believed wholeheartedly that things worked out. Maybe I was just obtuse to all her struggles, but it seemed like we always ended up okay. We'd never starved, we'd never gotten kicked out, or had the heat turned off in the winter. We'd survived. I wanted more than anything to study the disease that had ultimately killed my mother, and Dracadia was my chance, as Jada had said. I needed this. To know that I wasn't crazy, that I had seen those damned worms crawl out of her, and that it hadn't just been a figment of my imagination as I'd been led to believe. I had to figure something out anyway, whether I considered Dracadia or not, because I had a bad feeling about the crap Connor was getting wrapped up in with Angelo lately. For my and B's future, and the sake of our safety, I needed to find a way out.
Chapter 6. Beverick.
Please, don't do this!
The accused stood before the council, locked inside an enormous gilded cage.
I'm begging you!
The surrounding chamber was one of three ritual rooms in the catacombs of the Roost, a sprawling cathedral just outside of Dracadia University, owned by the Seven Rooks Society. Or the Rooks, as we were commonly referred. Gray concrete walls and floors added a sense of suffocation, like being buried alive inside a tomb. Fitting, really, given how utterly mind-numbing the ceremonies could be. Not even the multitude of flickering candles could brighten the cold and dreary crypt, at the center of which, etched in gold tiles, was the society's emblem, two crossed medical canes, like those used during the plague with a number 7. The same emblem that had been branded into my chest. Outside of the cathedral walls, we were a rumor, a myth, a secret whispered amongst the student body, fodder for conspiracies. Never seen, never heard. Crossed in front of his body, the accused's arms shook like fragile branches ready to snap. He was the only one not wearing one of the signature plague doctor masks that concealed the face of every other member in the room, including me. Deep black circles shadowed the accused's eyes, telling of little sleep, and the way he kept his gaze lowered, refusing to look at anyone, assured that he understood the severity of his crimes and what level of shit he was trudging. After all, every member of the Rooks knew not to steal. It was in the fucking handbook given to us as fledgling freshmen, and still clueless to the yet most serious manner in which the society upheld its laws, laws that were separate from those of the outside world, laws that had been in place for centuries and would continue to outlive every member in the room. The man standing before the council had been a member for nearly a decade of privilege and unimaginable power, whittled down to the thread of hope he so desperately clung to right then, the single prayer that the rooks would forgive his offenses. "Do you have anything to say for yourself?" Chairman Winthrop's articulate voice remained entirely recognizable, even slightly muffled behind his mask. His successor's untimely death had promoted him nearly 4 years prior, and since then, he kept to his vow of cleaning house in the organization. The accused stepped forward, gripping the golden bars of his cage, and lowered his gaze.
"Only that I know I've committed a grievous crime against my brothers. It was a moment of desperation and despair that inspired this unforgivable act. I beg your mercy. Grant me clemency, and I swear I will do whatever necessary to win your trust and your respect."
I snorted a laugh, and the sound echoed through the room, earning me the attention of a few masked faces and a terrified glance from the accused. Understandable, seeing as I happened to be the one from whom he'd stolen. Years of research that the accused had nearly sold off to some pharmaceutical mogul. One that would have surely exploited the work I'd tirelessly committed myself to since having won back some modicum of respect after my father's disastrous exit. Fortunately, the accused had gotten caught. They always got caught. His actual name was Paul Darrows, but that didn't matter anymore. As I understood, Darrows had a wife and kids. Tragic, given the trajectory of his fate at that moment, but the man had witnessed enough executions to be well acquainted with the consequences of his actions. The Rooks were one of three most powerful secret societies in the world, comprised of former CIA, FBI, presidents, inventors, all of whom had once sat in this very room at some point. How he thought he could have outsmarted them was beyond me. I'd only laughed at his earning trust and respect remark because the idiot had been caught with his pants down, literally pegged in the ass by his mistress, who'd probably wished she'd spent the night counting cracks in her ceiling instead of pounding the one that had undoubtedly made for a shitty night. Darrows had likely been swept up without a wisp of suspicion. No one, aside from the men in this room, would ultimately know his fate, and no one would ever tell, lest they wanted to be in the same position as the poor bastard.
"Let us vote on the matter."
From his black hooded robe, Winthrop removed the object pinned at his chest. What looked like a coin, about the size of a half dollar, it bore the Seven Rook Society emblem. One side of the coin was gold, representing the brotherhood, safety, and loyalty. The other side was black, a death sentence. Six other members removed their pins as well. Conviction required seven votes altogether, and the majority, a simple plus one, determined whether or not Darrows lived or died. One at a time, they laid their pins on the table before them. From my spot on the balcony, I watched a unanimous decision unravel, every pin black side up. The Rooks did not take kindly to thieves among us, after all, particularly since my research happened to be important not only to the members in the room, but the university and future of Dracadia.
"Brother Darrows, for the crimes of treachery, larceny, and the intended dispersal of confidential material, you are hereby deemed guilty."
Winthrop sat back in his chair and signaled to the right of him, where two other Rook members stood by.
"No!"
An outcry reverberated off the walls, and the cage man twisted away from the council, slamming himself into the unforgiving iron bars. He rattled the barrier, screaming and pleading for his life. There was no escape, though. His ties with the Brotherhood had been severed. He'd broken the sacred vows, the promise branded into his flesh, in all our flesh, the scar that bound all of us. He was no longer worthy of our mercy. Darrows made a hoarse plea, as if his executioners had any say over his fate, as if they would have dared to grant him mercy in the face of their superior brethren. The member known as the Executioner stepped forward. Unlike the black masks worn by every other member but Darrow's, his glistened a resplendent gold, the surface of which reflected the many flickering candles set about the room. I caught a flash of gold in the executioner's palm, a remote. A click of the button, and a glass wall slid down from the top of the cage to surround the bars, enclosing Darrow's inside. Two objects that looked like stage lights emerged from the floor within and snapped into place. A moment later, a sound like running water filled the room. The emitted gas was invisible, odorless and colorless. Unlike the masks used during the actual plague, the ones worn by the members effectively blocked out any fumes that might have seeped from the cage, a safety measure in case the glass bore a crack or gap. Darrow's covered his face with his hands and dropped to his knees, a futile attempt to stave off the deadly fumes that filled his enclosure. It didn't matter anyway. The gas took hold, invading his lungs and his brain through the cracks in his fingers. It perfused his muscles, and he collapsed to the side, seizing. Moments later, his body went still. The sound of scraping concrete erupted through the room as the tiled floor lowered, carrying the cage and Darrow's lifeless body within to the lower level, where he'd be incinerated and forgotten. A second, unoccupied tiled floor bearing the emblem rose up in its place, free of any evidence that Darrow's had ever stood before the council, that he had existed at all. His name would never again be spoken.
Chapter 7. Lilia. 2 weeks had passed since I'd received the invite to Dracadia. Unfortunately, the prospect of going was no closer to my reality than pink unicorns swooping down from the sky. I couldn't figure out a logistical way to make it happen, and no doubt the stress of that and everything else had gotten to me because I'd begun to see visions of my mom more frequently. Ever since Wilkins had told me those worms were real, my brain went haywire trying to convince me. Consequently, I'd grown overly exhausted, sleeping in class on occasion. Only to startle awake, humiliated, when I'd call out for her. I'd avoided my last microbiology lecture for the summer, not only for the embarrassment of having been awakened in class, but because I'd feared Professor Wilkins would ask me about Dracadia. Fall semester was due to begin in a week, and I hadn't done anything to secure my enrollment there. As if my finances weren't enough of a stressor, Connor had begun cleaning out my mother's room for a new roommate. Thankfully, he'd given up on the notion of Angelo moving in, a small sliver of light in the chaos. He must have teased out the stupidity of having a man like that around all the time. I hoped that was the case anyway. I'd left for work that evening without a word, while he stacked boxes of what personal belongings of my mother's I was willing to part with. Having put off going through her stuff long enough, Connor had finally threatened to toss everything out, if I didn't separate what I'd wanted to keep. So I'd made a stash for B and me, albums, jewelry, paintings, and some of Mom's old clothes. The sight of her empty room left a hollow ache in my chest, and as much as I knew we needed the cash, I couldn't stand the thought that a stranger would eventually be filling that space. Exhausted with stress, I entered the staff lounge and crossed to the lockers there, forcing myself to meet Jada's bright-eyed smile with my own. "Hey," I said, twisting the dial on the lock. "Hey." The enthusiasm in her voice seemed a little off, and I glanced back to find she'd moved in closer, still smiling. "Is everything okay?" I turned back toward the dial, pained from having to hold a cordial expression so long, and clicked open my locker where I tossed my bag inside. "Yes, I've got something for you, but I want you to know giving it back isn't an option, okay?" Head muddled with new curiosity, I pressed my locker door closed and turned to face her, noticing her arms hidden behind her back. "What is it?" "Just a little congratulations." From behind her back, she drew a purple envelope about the size of a card and handed it to me. "For what?" Her face pinched to a frown. "What do you mean, for what? Why do you have to act like getting a scholarship to an Ivy League school is no big deal?" I suddenly wished I'd never told her about Dracadia, as if my guilt hadn't already reached peak levels as it was. "I can't afford to just up and leave." "So you're going to let that opportunity languish?" "I don't want to, no. But my options are shit at the moment." "Open the card, Lilia." At a cautious pace, I pulled open the envelope to find a congratulations card inside, flipping it open loose to a stack of bills. Hundreds, fifties, twenties, tens. I didn't even have to count to know there was at least $1,000 inside. My heart kicked up. The sting of tears burned my nose and I shook my head. I told Danica about you getting accepted into school. Danica was our lead manager for the department, with whom I'd always had a decent relationship, so it didn't trouble me that Jada had told her. Anyway, she rallied all the docs and nurses to pitch in for some extra cash, about $1,000 and some change. Enough to cover 2 months of B's tuition. My cut, anyway. Plus a little extra. Did it give me a head start? Let me find a job and possibly save up a couple more months? I can't accept this. It's too much, Jay. Non-negotiable, baby. That money is yours. She threw up her hand in a dismissive way and shook her head. And you don't have to pay it back, so don't even go there. But classes begin Monday, a week from today. I don't even know if they'd let me enroll this late. I missed orientation and registration. I don't know anything about that school shit. But I will say, you better hustle to see if you're still good to register. Holding that thick stack of bills in my hand, the impossibilities from before seemed, well, possible. I couldn't imagine a world where the only thing I had to worry about was school. I don't know what to say. No one has ever done anything like this for me before. What you say is simple. Repeat after me. I, Lilia Vespertine. Brow winged up, she paused, waiting on me. I, Lilia Vespertine, am going to fucking Dracadia University. I released a tearful chuckle. I'm going to fucking Dracadia University. A beam of pride glinted in Jada's eyes as she folded her arms and smiled. And there you have it. All the thanks we need. I wrapped my arms around her, desperately holding back a sob, because goddamn it, she didn't have to do what she had, and there was no way I could pay her back. Not until I finished my degree in a decade's time. Thank you. You're welcome. Would it be selfish if I asked for one more favor? Depends on the favor, she said in a flat voice that made me smile. Releasing her, I stepped back. Can I stay with you this week? Connor's cleaning out my mom's room, just not really interested in sticking around for that. You absolutely can. Pack your bags and do what you gotta do tonight. From a shelf beside our locker, she grabbed a head cap and wound her long braids into it, a practice she'd put into place after having haphazardly dipped her hair into a dirty bucket of water. I'll bring Quentin along to come pick you up. Are you sure? I pulled my hair back into a loose ponytail at my neck. I don't want to put you guys out. I can take an Uber to your place. I insist. You don't need all that weight on you right now. You got shit to plan for. Again, I found myself trying to wrap my head around the possibility that I might soon be walking that mystical-looking campus. At break, I used one of the staff computers to shoot Dean Langmore a quick email, asking if it was too late to register for classes. At a little after 10, I didn't expect a reply, but when his name popped up in my inbox just before I closed out, my tongue damn near fell out of my mouth.
Absolutely, Miss Vespertine. I've attached the link for registration, as well as the welcome packet you would have received at orientation last week.
The attached file read, Welcome to Dracadia University. Biting my cheek failed to contain the smile, itching to break free. Because I, Lilia Vespertine, was going to fucking Dracadia University. My shift flew by, and before leaving for home, I'd made a point to both thank and chide Danica. As I sat on the subway, clutching my bag, I stared through the window, desperate to hold back a smile so I didn't look like a weirdo smiling at my own reflection, while I imagined myself as an Ivy League student. My campus. My school. Life felt unreal. A dream. I'd left for my shift that evening, weighed down by hopelessness and disappointment. Suddenly, I had a plan. The moment I entered the apartment, I quieted my footsteps, eyes scanning for Connor in the dim light. No doubt he'd have given me a hard time about leaving, and I just couldn't afford that when my head still grappled with the decision. I headed straight for my bedroom, the knots tightening even more as I turned the knob and dashed for the closet to grab my suitcase, pausing to nab a few sweatshirts. I hoisted the suitcase onto the bed and twisted for the dresser, sloppily piling in jeans, a couple of skirts that I'd bought for job interviews, dresses I'd taken from Mom's old wardrobe, sweaters, underwear, socks, my trinket box. I tossed in my favorite blanket, a picture of Bea, Mom, and me, and my mom's painting. A charger and toiletries. From my desk, I grabbed the invitation to Dracadia and stuffed it inside my bag. Everything fit perfectly inside the suitcase, and it was only when I grabbed the zipper that I felt an ominous presence at my door.
Think you forgot something.
The distressing sound of Angelo's voice skated down the back of my neck, and I turned to see him clutching a pair of my satin panties to his face. Lowering my gaze, I reached out a hand. Give them to me.
Think I'll keep them as a souvenir.
Hiding my irritation with him, I finished zipping up my suitcase. Do what you want, Angelo. I'm done with you, this town, all of it.
Tell me where you're going, and I'll give them back.
Don't you think you're a little old to be playing games? I hoisted the suitcase off the bed. No way I plan to stay in the apartment with this walking shit stain. Even if I had to wait on the street for an hour until Quentin arrived, at least there'd be witnesses to whatever bullshit he tried to pull. What the hell are you even doing here, anyway? How did you get in?
Tell me where you're going.
He said again, ignoring my questions. No. Muscles straining, I carried the suitcase across the room, halting in front of the door he blocked. Move. He didn't budge so much as an inch. A rush of something shot through me. Fear, adrenaline. I couldn't tell, but the potency of it vibrated my bones. Get out of my way, Angelo. I'm not playing games. He still didn't move. Fuck you, I said, ready to plow into him. He clamped his hand over mine and pushed down on the suitcase that I struggled to lift, weighing it down until it was too heavy to hold.
You're not going anywhere, little girl.
God, the stench that wafted off of him. Who'd have guessed a man could smell like a literal grave? Pretty sure cutting him open would have sent a corpse spilling out.
Well, Angelo, brought some conies home. Come on and eat.
The sound of Connor's voice stoked a turbulent mix of relief and alarm. I'd hoped to be gone before he got home. The note I'd written was a sad and inadequate exit, but I couldn't take a chance he'd try to guilt-trip me, or that we'd fight, and I'd end up pissing him off enough to withdraw B's tuition.
Sounds delicious.
Angelo called back, his lips curving to a smile.
By the looks of things, you weren't planning to tell Connor either.
He pushed off the wall and headed down the hallway toward the kitchen. Much as I had the urge to slip out the window of my bedroom, I owed it to Connor to at least tell him what was going on. Exhaling a sigh, I left my bag in the bedroom and made my way through to them. Coney in hand, Connor frowned as I stood in the doorway.
Hey, Angelo says you're heading out. Where to?
I'm staying at a friend's. Why the hell was he here before you?
We were having a meeting. I ran out to grab dinner. He stayed.
Brow winged up, he stared back.
What friend are you staying with?
Someone from school, I lied. You don't know her. With a shrug, Connor bit into his coney, dribbling sauce down his chin. Angelo tapped his finger against the table while his uneaten coney sat in its paper tray in front of him.
That's it?
He asked, not taking those creepy eyes off me.
Aren't you gonna ask who?
Frowning, Connor wiped his chin across his forearm, taking the bit of sauce with it.
The fuck do I care? She's 20 years old.
Relief uncoiled some of the knots in my gut. So much so, I didn't want to dare disrupt the mood by telling him about Dracadia. I'd call him, leave the note in his lunchbox, send a carrier pigeon or owl. Something that didn't involve Angelo.
Ah, there's something else, though, isn't there, Lil?
Angelo's face stretched to a wicked smile that I could have slapped with a fly swatter right then. I shook my head, swallowing back the dryness in my throat.
Oh, come now. There was something about a Dracadia, I believe.
The theatrics in his voice grated on me. And I would have happily sacrificed my pinky toe to watch the ceiling cave in on him. The asshole had clearly opened the envelope on my desk. He had been in our apartment for God knew how long and had rifled through my shit.
The hell is that?
Connor asked, shoving another bite into his mouth.
Sounds like something out of one of them vampire movies.
It's a university. I was accepted there. I offered reluctantly. Connor's brows winged up, his eyes bright with surprise.
Oh, yeah? That's great, Lil. Congratulations. Is this, another community college?
Shifting my attention brought Angelo's smug grin to the fore.
No, it's an Ivy League college about 3 hours north of here. 3 hours?
Connor buried his frown into a long swill of beer. And when he placed the bottle down, the frown had deepened.
And did you just say Ivy League? Is this a joke? You can barely pay for 2 classes at Covington.
I had to tread carefully, for B's sake. In spite of the tensity simmering in my blood. Telling him that I had been gifted money would have been stupid, particularly in front of Angelo. I received a full paid scholarship. The cluck of his tongue told me he wasn't happy.
Well, that's not gonna work. You got B and half the rent here.
This is my one and only opportunity, Connor. My one chance. And I'm not going to be made to feel guilty. I stayed when I didn't have to. I helped when I could have left. And I never asked you for anything, ever. But I'm asking you now to be the decent guy my mom loved all those years ago and help me out, please. What I surmised as understanding flashed across Connor's face, and he let out a huff.
Angelo, give us a moment, will you?
Angelo's jaw shifted, his stare more intense.
I could use a smoke.
With that, he pushed up from his chair and, never taking his eyes off me, strode out of the room. At the click of the door, I let out a relieved exhale. Thank you. Arms crossed, Connor stared down at the floor.
So, this school. Wow. You think you can handle all this?
Finally, a real conversation, without all the show of dominance. I'm gonna try. He rubbed his jaw and blew out a resigned breath.
Fine, I'll figure out rent. I got some applicants for the room. Callahan mentioned some interest in it.
Jesus, I'd take Lady Callahan any day over Angelo, that was for sure.
So long as you can still help me with B?
He asked, and I smiled, glad to know that was still a priority for him. I've got a little cash saved for it. I'll get a job at school. They have work study, and maybe I can get another evening gig. Lips thinned to a straight line, he nodded.
You were always a smart kid, Lil. From the time you was little, you know? Smart little shit. Your mom.
With the back of his thumb, he scratched his nose.
Now I know she'd be proud.
Thanks.
The room will be here for you. And B, I won't rent it out or anything.
Not that I plan to come back for any great length of time if I could help it. Even if things didn't work out at Dracadia, I intended to use the move as an opportunity to be on my own. Still, it was decent of Connor. I appreciate that.
When do you go?
I'm leaving right now. Staying with a friend for a few days. Then she's going to take me to the train station.
All right.
He rubbed his jaw again and stepped forward, as if to hug me, but hesitated and stepped back again. Lips pulling to a half-smile, I held out my hand for a shake, to which he reciprocated. Take care, Connor.
Yeah, take care.
Chapter 8. Beverick. Hunting the inebriated was horribly anticlimactic. A white vaporous mist danced across wet cobblestones as I made my way down a shadowy alley in the heart of Emberwick, a moderately sized, moody village just outside of Dracadia University. Like most of the villages on the island, it had retained its old century charm, with French Gothic architecture and vine-covered shops. A dizzying maze of coffee houses, bookshops, museums, and as I understood, the most decadent chocolate on the East Coast. Hardly a place for depravity, but that was exactly what I sought there. The lingering scent of rose perfume clung to my shirt, the nauseating stench of a quick, incurious fuck. It was sickening, the way the mind could eventually grow numb to the parasitic needs of the flesh. I'd made a point to meet twice a week with Loretta Gilchrist, the entomology professor, to burn off the pent-up agony of an insatiable sexual appetite. A mundane but effective therapy, up until that evening, when I'd been put off by the woman. Not because she was 10 years older than me, or that she had a tendency to fall into a coughing fit during her climax. Though our routine had gotten somewhat loathsome, I'd always appreciated the intense release I couldn't seem to find during any other physical activity,
and even if she wasn't the most exciting conquest, I appreciated the subtlety of our meetings. Unfortunately, she'd broken my no-touch rule. Ordinarily, I'd have bound her arms to avoid the mistake, but that evening I'd been hasty and irritated by my body's needs. The incessant intrusion of thought which had rendered me anxious to get it over with, to fuck and be done with it, so I could return to my studies. To my utter disappointment, she took my oversight as a show of growth, or worse, affection. The very thought of such a thing sent a shiver of horror down my spine. Even then, more than an hour later, I could still feel the invisible mark of her hand on my skin. I ground my teeth at the ghostly imprint of her cold fingertips across my shoulder, from where it faded down the length of my arm to my entirely insensate fingers. Not even the most excessive scrubbing could rid me of her unwanted touch. I scratched at my shoulder as I kept on down the alley, until in the darkest corner of the village I found the man I'd sought out, one who'd been living in hiding. For that, the island made a perfect cloak. Admittedly, it hadn't been entirely random that I'd chosen him, and on a prior visit to the village, I'd watched the man scurry out of a corner market toward a quiet place beneath a tree in the nearby park. There, with shaky hands, he unbagged a fifth of cheap whiskey and swallowed it straight from the bottle like water. The alcoholism was obvious. What I hadn't known at the time was that the man had abused his wife and sons, his youngest to the point of his having fallen comatose. Wanted by police, he was on the run for an entire lifetime of crimes for which he'd never paid the piper. Perhaps that should have been good cause to turn him over to authorities, to act the hero for once in my godforsaken life. Heroics were boring. The man in the alley had been lured to Dracadia Island with the promise of money and refuge, but as it turned out, his ticket to asylum had never materialized. He'd been duped, and with no other resources, had remained on the island. A most unfortunate fate. As I strode closer, an intense jolt of agony struck my skull, bringing me to a skidding halt. Like a shock to my brain, it radiated out from its pulse points at either side of my head, just above my ears. The pain, like blades dragging over bone, viced my muscles, and a sharp ringing in my ears dropped me to my knees. Involuntary clenching of my teeth shot piercing spasms to my temples and eyeballs, locking my jaw. Quiet growls rumbled in my throat, my muscles shaking with a stabbing misery. A cold nausea expanded inside my chest, and I breathed through my nose. 1, 2, 3, 4, until the intensity lessened. The needling ache dulled and dulled. Eyes closed, I took deep breaths, focusing on the relief. The loosening of tension and slackening of clenched teeth. Seconds later, it diminished, and I fell onto my palms, catching my breath. Cold, wet stones dampened my knees through the slacks, and the balmy air cooled the sweat across my skin. The headaches had gotten worse in recent months, and often struck without warning. A worrisome evolution. With the pain finally subsided, I pushed to my feet and kept on down the alley. The man I'd sought lay slumped against the aging brick wall beside a line of trash cans, remnants of what I presumed was vomit speckled a dark, shabby beard. I gave a light kick to the man's leg, and he didn't so much as flinch. Crouching to check his pulse, I was relieved to find a weak throbbing below his skin. An object sticking up from the man's ragged coat drew my attention, and with a gloved hand, I lifted a picture from his pocket. A clean-shaven version of him stood beside a young woman, perhaps no more than 30, and two little boys, who looked to be about 8 and 10. I tucked the picture back into the man's coat, making a mental note to burn it later. With that, I lifted him to his feet, to the sounds of grumbling and mumbling, and wrapped the stranger's arm around my neck for balance. A repulsive odor singed my nose as I dragged him toward the mouth of the alley, where my car remained parked, waiting for him. I sat in the shadows, on an old wooden chair, waiting for Alley Man to fully wake. Groans echoed through the dank and dreary quarters of Emmerich Tower's catacombs, which had housed prisoners centuries before. The maze of tunnels had been closed off and sealed sometime in the late 1700s, well before it had been purchased and turned into a university for clergymen. It was only by happenstance, during my junior year at Dracadia when, bored with physics recitation held two floors above, my classmate and I had snuck away for a cigarette and had stumbled upon what looked to be a doorframe's mantle. Weeks of hacking away at the rock-like mud, which had hardened to a stony barricade, had opened the entrance and revealed the archaic lab once belonging to Dr. Sterling. The pitch-black tunnels, untouched by light for centuries, had led us to the dark, abandoned cells. Long-forgotten prisons that still held the decayed bones of whomever had been unfortunate enough to dwell there. I'd since installed lighting throughout the tunnels, but even in the thick of summer, the ancient passageway casted an unnerving chill. The man from the alley raised a trembling hand to his head, his eyes slowly fluttering open. He lay on the floor of his cell for a moment, perhaps trying to discern where in the hell he'd been taken. On a gasped breath, he shot upright and kicked himself back against the wall. Panicked eyes fell on me as I watched with intrigue. Where am I? A thick rattle in his voice hinted at thirst and likely dehydration. The sound persisted on each ragged breath that followed. Dracadia University, Emmerich Tower, to be exact. Who are you? I plucked a piece of lint from my black slacks and offered a small but insincere smile. Professor Bramwell, which is entirely irrelevant. The man scrambled toward the bars of his cage, fingers curling around the thick iron posts.
What am I doing in here? I want out, now!
Calm yourself, Mr. Barletta. I reached forward, the movement creaking the old chair as I grabbed a fifth of McAllen from the gritty floor beside me. Tell me, have you ever had decent whiskey in your life? A longing in Barletta's eyes told me his craving for alcohol outweighed his fear right then, and the man licked his lips.
I don't think I have.
I held up the bottle in taunting. It's delicious, smooth, like warm hazelnuts with notes of sherry. Would you like some? A spark of desperation lit his otherwise dull, roomy eyes.
I would.
I reached forward, passing through the bottle that only just fit between the bars of the man's cage. With haste, the stranger swiped it out of my hands, popped the cap, and chugged a good quarter of the expensive liquor before he lowered it from his lips. On a sigh of relief, he fell back against the wall and held the bottle against his chest, like he was cradling a small child.
You're right, Bramwell. It's good. Real fucking good.
He kicked back an even longer swill than the last, 2 grand's worth of liquor in his gullet.
Now tell me why I'm here.
Exhaling a resigned breath, I sat forward and rested my elbows on my thighs.
Very well. I am a pathologist here at the university, the primary researcher for a parasitology project that's funded by exceptionally wealthy and powerful individuals. That's great. The fuck does that have to do with me?
I'm glad you asked. It so happens I am in desperate need of human subjects. Chuckling, he rolled his head against the wall to face me.
The answer is no. I'm not your fucking guinea pig. Now let me go.
Lowering my gaze, I smiled and eased back in my chair again. Oh, I wasn't asking your permission, Mr. Barletta. You see, the whiskey you just chugged contains thousands of tiny eggs, each of them encased in a wonderful spore-like outer shell that protects it from the ethanol. In 2 days, those eggs will be embryonated as they settle into your nutrient-rich liver. The larvae will continue to grow inside of you, and in another 6 days will hatch from their eggs. That's when the real fun begins. I watched with pointed amusement as the color drained from his face and his jaw slackened with shock, and perhaps a bit of disbelief. The larvae will then release potent toxins that will breach your blood-brain barrier. The toxins will intensify your most basic needs: thirst, hunger, sex. When the parasite finally realizes there is no warm and cozy womb to lay more of their eggs and complete their cycle, the adult worms will then aggressively begin to feed on your liver in an attempt to fatten themselves for survival. You will ultimately go into organ failure and die, and that is when you will finally expel them. Sighing, I shrugged.
But I wouldn't fret. You were well on your way to liver failure anyway. Barletta jumped to all fours and shoved a pudgy finger down his throat. Vomit poured from his mouth and nose onto the floor. As he retched and gagged, I tugged a small pocket watch from my slacks and polished its surface on my shirt, noting the time was just before midnight before I stuffed it away again. It's futile. Say, for the sake of arguing, you managed to expel a good few hundred eggs. There are still many more on their way to your liver now, which I'm guessing is in a grotesque state of cirrhosis at this point. He shoved a finger into his throat again and let out a hoarse cough.
You sick fuck! You sick and twisted fuck! Let me go!
Sick fuck. I gave you shelter. Expensive drink. It's not as if I battered your skull with a liquor bottle and left you comatose. That would have been absolutely unconscionable. His eyes widened, and he fell back onto his heels, letting out a weary sob. What separates monsters from good men is only a matter of perspective. In your eyes, I'm a sick fuck for what I've done to you. But I, on the other hand, see you as a parasite. Swiping up the bottle, he threw it at me. On impact with the iron cage bars, the broken glass crashed to the floor. Now that's a shame. I estimate in about an hour you're going to be going through some fairly intense withdrawals. Lips flattened, I shook my head and pushed up from the chair. With one hand clasped behind my back, I lifted a piece of the glass where a small amount of liquor had pooled on its surface. While the eggs were virtually invisible, the fluid seemed to move with the wriggling of the parasite contained inside of its cocoon. Smirking, I tossed it away. I was the one who offered money and asylum on Dracadia Island, the one who lured you here. Again, a flare of disbelief shined in his eyes.
You? Why?
The why will be revealed later. There is a fragile thread that ties us, Mr. Barletta. A sharp strike of pain hit either side of my head, and eyes screwed shut, I let out a grunt, rubbing the heel of my palm where the agony damn near vibrated my skull. Whatever Barletta said to me after fizzled to an annoying blur of sound, until it came back into sharp focus, and I opened my eyes. A short episode that time, thankfully.
Fucking let me out of here!
Nabbing one of the broken pieces of glass, he drove his arm through the space between the cage bars in a pathetic attempt to cut me. I chuckled and shook my head with a pitying expression that undoubtedly pissed him off. Consider this penance. Your opportunity to save a life, for once. I shoved my hands into my pockets and turned away. I can see you're upset. I'll return tomorrow with some breakfast. Barletta's screams echoed behind me as I strode down the corridor.
Chapter 9. Lilia. Are you sure this is the place? Jada asked beside me, as both of us stared through the windshield of her car toward the train station. At least, I thought it was a train station. Heat withered weeds stuck up through the cracked concrete, and the dilapidated building, where a ticket sign hung half-cocked, didn't even look open. The place looked abandoned, with garbage scattered over the parking lot and colorful words graffitied across one of the stationary train cars. After another glance down at the invitation sitting in my lap, I nodded. It's the address on the invitation. How about I stay a bit, just in case? You have to be up in 4 hours to work. I'll be fine. Girl, it's work. It'll be there tomorrow and the day after that. I can't say the same for you if I leave. I've got my blade and my pepper spray. That should at least get me a head start, right? Besides, it's 12:45. The train should theoretically be here in 15 minutes. If it's theoretically coming at all. Jada leaned forward, and I had a pretty good idea that we both saw the same guy in threadbare clothes leaning up against the building when she shook her head and said, I'm just going to stay. That way, if it doesn't come, I'm already here to take you back. Smiling, I eased back in my seat, secretly relieved that she wasn't going. I'd always taken care of myself, but sometimes it was nice having someone look out for you. I know you don't like Sappy, but... She threw up a hand between us. Don't do it. I don't know what I'd do without you in my life. Stop it, okay? Stop it. The same hand she used to blockade came to rest on my knuckles and gave a gentle squeeze. You're stronger than you realize, Lilia. You just need to start believing it. I will, when you start accepting compliments and gratitude. She snorted and turned away, retracting her hand as I chuckled. 10 minutes passed. The anxiety knotted my stomach while I gnawed on my bottom lip. I'd never been outside of Massachusetts before. Had never traveled by train or plane. We'd taken camping trips sometimes when my mom was still alive, but never farther than a few counties over. To say that I was nervous was a bit of an understatement. Maybe we should just go, I said to Jada at 2 minutes past midnight. No sooner had the words tumbled past my lips than a rattling of my water bottle in its cup holder drew my attention there. I glanced down to see the surface rippling. Jada turned toward me, wearing a quizzical expression. Not a second later, light cut through the misty fog. A loud hum rose from the distance, white noise beneath the screech of metal on metal. A horn sounded, pounding in my chest, and I jolted forward to see the homeless guy startle awake. The two of us climbed out of the vehicle, and after grabbing my suitcase and backpack from the back seat, I walked cautiously ahead of the car to see an enormous, shadowy form slice through the overhang of trees. A monstrous vehicle ground down its pace, and on an angry squeal, it let out one final chug and rolled to a stop. My mouth hung wide as I took in the magnificence of it. A shiny black surface over which gold details gave it a luxurious appearance. The side of it read Dracadian Express in glittery gold font with the head of a gold dragon curved over the lettering. It idled while I marveled the exterior, and through darkened windows I noticed obscure figures moving about, what I presumed to be other passengers inside. From the right, a man clad in a black suit and hat with gold embroidery on his lapel strode toward me. It was only based on a handful of movies I'd watched that led me to believe he might have been the train conductor.
Boarding pass?
He asked, and I rifled through the envelope I held. The shiny black ticket matched the train with its gold dragon and beautiful metallic gold font, and I handed it off to him. The university has its own train?
It's owned by the university, but it serves all of Jacadia and Maine.
The conductor pointed toward an entrance where a ramp slowly retracted down.
You're in car two. Lounge and observation are toward the front. Have a few more stops, and we should arrive to the port city by 5 in the morning.
With a nod, I smiled, the excitement buzzing inside of me. Okay.
Welcome aboard, Miss Vespertine.
He lifted my suitcase, and my muscles lurched to take it back. That single bag held everything I owned, my whole life, essentially. I had to remind myself it wasn't Covington public transportation. What I owned was probably considered junk in the world I was about to enter. Well, this is it, Jada said beside me. I turned to see the pride-filled smile on her face as she stared toward the train. I'll be back to visit. You better. She wrapped her arms around me, squeezing the air out of my lungs. You take care of yourself, Dr. Lilia. Thank you for everything, I whispered, and with that she released me, stepping back so I could see a shine in her eyes. Go on. Your future is waiting. At the first sting of tears, I double-blinked them away and turned toward the train. Willing myself not to cry, I sucked in a deep breath and strode up the ramp after the conductor, past the luggage rack, and through the automated door that opened car two. The seats within flaunted a plush black velvet with gold lettering, arranged in rows of two at either side of the long aisle I traversed toward my seat. The handful of passengers I passed peered down at their cell phones. Clad in designer clothes, blazers, and blouses, with bags that probably cost as much as I made in a month, they fit the part of an Ivy League student. I'd taken some of the money Jada had given me to go thrifting for something decent to wear. I had an appreciation for vintage dresses, thanks to my mother, who'd always told me that dresses and skirts were a woman's rebellion against the world's ruthless nature. Soft and vulnerable and bold at the same time. I'd never been brave enough to wear them on the subway late at night, only to classes during the day. For the train ride, I'd opted for a pale butter, ruffled sundress with my mom's faded leather jacket and my combat boots. While I didn't look homeless, I certainly wasn't as put together as the other passengers, those whose jewelry dangled from their wrists and necks like extravagant tinsel. Sprawled in their seats with their phones, they looked completely at ease, perhaps even bored and unimpressed. Meanwhile, I sat humming like a bee with so much pent-up anxiety it was a wonder they couldn't hear me vibrating in my seat. My knees bounced incessantly as the train trundled forward. I turned toward the window and waved as I watched Jada pass me, like I was watching my old life slip away for the new one. I hadn't even had time to let it sink into my head that I'd be attending an Ivy League school, a respected university. Clawing at my own arm failed to break me out of the strange dream. Things weren't entirely worked out with Connor and Bea either. I'd sent along 2 months of my half of payment to Bea's school account, but I'd need to find a job right away to begin saving up and staying ahead in addition to work study. My load would be heavy, but hadn't it always been that way? Focus on the now, Lilia. The words of my mother, who'd always managed to calm my anxiety when I was a kid. I closed my eyes, resting my head against the cushiony seat, a far cry from the hard plastic I was accustomed to on the subway. I needed some sleep, even just a few hours, so I wouldn't look like a zombie when I arrived on campus. As I stole the moment to take a quick snooze, my thoughts grew distant.
Chapter 10. Devrick. Dragging the scalpel down from the acromion to the center of the chest, and then toward the abdomen, I made a Y incision on the decedent's body. I'd already performed an external exam and confirmed that she was, in fact, Andrea Kepling, sent from Calypso County Medical Examiner's Office for confirmation on the cause of death. The faded black map of veins, or vanixis, I'd noted, on external examination served as the first clue. However, a few different parasitic toxins were known to cause the discoloration, so it didn't necessarily confirm a case. The second clue was the putrid, dark-colored fluid seeping from the incision. With how long she'd been stored, I'd have expected some fluid ejection, but not the profuse liquids that dripped into the catch basin under the examination table. And fuck, that stench. Not even retained shit in the bowels smelled as horrible. A tickle at my ankle drew my attention to the floor, where a black ball of fur circled my legs like he had any right to be there. A Bombay cat I'd inherited after he'd somehow gotten into my lab, and I couldn't for the life of me get rid of the damn thing. He kept the mice and rats away, though, so I'd decided to let the nosy little bastard stick around. "I see you decided to show up," I said behind the mask and shield covering my face. "Almost started without you." The cat, whom I'd named Bane, sauntered his way across the room and settled in the corner opposite me, where he licked his paws. Forceps in hand, I carefully peeled back the decedent's skin like a butterfly, exposing her ribcage beneath. Nothing exceptionally notable about the skin or the bones still covered in remnants of flesh. Aside from the darkened veins, the state of her body at that point seemed rather unremarkable for one supposedly having been ravaged by disease. It was what I'd hoped to find within that would tell a sinister and grim story for how she might have died. Next, I grabbed the rib shears and snapped each of the connecting bones. With a post-mortem knife, I sliced away the muscles holding it in place and lifted away the rib shield, exposing the organs beneath. Using the broad end of the knife, I shaved a small bit of the muscle from the bone, noting another defining characteristic of the parasite bone striations. If I were to remove all of the muscle and flesh, her skeleton would undoubtedly be covered in faint black lines, like tiny fissures in the bones. Why or how the parasite managed such a thing remained a mystery. I collected a small sliver of flesh onto an awaiting auger plate for later examination and set it aside, then made a quick dictation on visual exam of the heart, lungs, and fluids collected in the spaces. Not water, though. Aside from excessive inflammation, I didn't find evidence of aspiration into the lungs. Only the thicker, serum-like fluid, which I believed had seeped from the GI tract during patient transportation. I ladled about a liter of the molded fluid from her abdomen and chest cavity into a sterile jar. As I held it up to the light, I couldn't help but wonder how many eggs it might have contained. Tying a string to the bowel, I cut the fat away from her body, and once free, I dumped the entrails into the awaiting bucket beneath the table. As I meticulously removed each of the organs and weighed them, I finally reached the one I'd been interested in from the beginning, the liver. In her case, it was about a quarter of the size it should have been, black, nubbly, and oozing the fluids I'd collected earlier.
In the absence of the parasite itself, it confirmed Noctisoma. I'd never seen another parasite ravage the liver quite the same. Enzymes released by the worm liquefied the organ for faster consumption and made for one hell of a slimy mess. Movement caught my eye. I peered through the irritating face shield barrier that reflected the light to find something wriggling in a pool of liquid in the interstitium. With the forceps, I poked around and lifted out a long, black, skinny worm, about a foot long. "Fucking hell," I muttered. The head of the worm latched onto my glove, and though I felt nothing, the sight of it chomping onto my finger startled me, and I dropped it back into the decedent's abdominal cavity. Damn it! The worm slid over the flap of skin and down the edge of the examination table. I lurched for the floor drain just a few feet away, but before I could cover it with my shoe, the parasite slipped through the drain holes. And just like that, it was gone. Not even Bane, my cat, could get to it fast enough, as he sat pawing at the drain, clearly depressed for the missed opportunity. He somehow had the intuition not to eat the worms, thankfully. At most, he'd have only slowed it down. Fuck. Fuck! I peeled off the glove to find a tiny bubble of blood beating at the surface of my skin. Since when had they grown fucking teeth? As I stared down at the carved decedent, my thoughts rewound to the quick briefing Lippincott had given me before I had agreed to perform the autopsy. She's a special case. What made her special? After washing the wound with soap, I covered it with a band-aid before donning a new pair of gloves and set back to seeing if her body would tell me. By the time I reached her brain, I already had the scenario of her death clear in my head. Having witnessed the progression a few times, I knew what the worms inside of her had ultimately wanted. Escape. I saw the last bit of her skull and, with a skull key, pried off the top crown of bone to expose her brain beneath. Black lines proved the presence of the toxin in high concentration, and the presence of blood lent some insight into how she died, confirmed by the attached radiological report stating she'd suffered a stroke. After cutting away all the nerve connections, I removed the gelatinous organ and set it aside. In cutting away slices, I found what I was looking for in the prefrontal cortex, a pocket contained within a clear membranous sac wherein the purest toxin, aside from what could have been harvested from the liver about a week prior, remained perfectly encased. With a needle tip, I pipetted the fluid from inside and deposited it into a prepared test tube. I held up the bright purple fluid with its black marbled threads to the light. Might have been entirely too late to utilize anything, as she'd been dead for quite some time. Although I'd have gotten the best results within minutes of death, it was still worth hanging on to the sample. Perhaps whatever hell the woman had suffered in life with her illness might one day offer a sliver of promise in her death. Back at my office in the administrative quarter, I stared at my bandaged finger, my head trying to wrap itself around what I'd seen during the autopsy. Clearly the worm had evolved, and I suspected it might have been due to repeated inoculation in humans. A hardy human liver certainly could have been reason enough to grow teeth. A knock at the door interrupted my thoughts. I cleared my throat. Come in. The door creaked open to Dr. Lippincott, provost of Dracadia, a longtime friend of my father's. Hands tucked into his pockets, he strode across the room, the sight of him souring my already cantankerous mood. "I don't suppose you have any liquor hiding in here somewhere?" he asked, brows winged up with a sickening hope. Of course I did. After all, one didn't take a job working for high-class assholes without something to numb the misery of it all. I reached down into the bottom drawer of my desk and grabbed a bottle of bourbon, along with two glasses. "Brace yourself, Devrick." Lippincott was the only one who didn't bother to address me by doctor or professor. I hadn't decided whether it was a friendly gesture or meant to be condescending. After pouring him a glass, I passed the liquor to him, watching as he polished it in one gulp, then signaled me to pour another. "I just met with Langmore for an hour. Apparently he received a call from Albert Wilkins. Do you remember Albert at all?" "Yes, Dracadia's finest alcoholic," I answered, watching Lippincott toss back another shot. "Well, he's done his time, gotten sober, and seems to be working for some community college in Massachusetts. Anyway, Langmore claims he called to tell him of a student of his who was tasked with writing some mind-blowing case study involving a parasite. Adorable. I kick my feet up onto my desk, not so patiently waiting for the point of his story. So, what about that exactly warranted an hour-long meeting?
Langmore requested funds to cover her first semester entirely. I understand she happens to be quite brilliant, unanimously approved by the admissions committee.
He flicked his fingers, seeking more liquor. And I poured another round into his glass.
He placed her in your neuroparasitology rotation.
That better have been one fuck of a research paper she wrote.
I didn't actually read it.
He snorted and waved his hands dismissively.
Do you have any idea how many student essays cross my desk? It's a literary slush pile of the poor and helpless requesting financial assistance. Who the hell has time for that? My bigger concern is that Langmore might be trying to fast-track these students behind my back, and if that's the case, I intend to catch the weaselly bastard red-handed. Therefore, I'd like her to stay in your class. If you detect any monkey business with the asshole, report to me. I've got my reappointment coming up, and I don't need any surprises.
You're asking me to babysit an undergrad.
The tone of my voice couldn't have been more unenthusiastic.
Who is she?
Lilia Vespertine. Perhaps you can take her on as an assistant.
Absolutely not. I took another sip of my whiskey, relishing the burn in my throat as I swallowed back the urge to punch him. Lippincott buried a chuckle in his glass.
At the very least, I want to monitor her while she's here. If he attempts to place her in any other advanced class without prior authorization, his ass will be canned.
Upper lip curled into his teeth, he shook his head.
I've been waiting for the opportunity to get rid of him, and that nosy bitch, Gilchrist, he said through clenched teeth.
And what of the girl in that case?
We deny her financial assistance for the second semester. She was awarded a Meritus scholarship for financial hardship. There isn't a chance in hell that she could attend the school otherwise.
He ran his finger over the perimeter of his glass, eyes unfocused.
On a separate note, I understand you've completed the autopsy report for Andrea Kepling. May I ask the findings?
Bone striations, near complete putrefaction of the liver, von Uxus. Bilateral tapetum lucidum. Significant levels of toxin isolated from the brain and liver. Nothing surprising. I didn't bother to mention the worm with fucking teeth.
So we're calling it noctosomiasis.
The presence of the toxin is fairly indicative, I think. He let out a hearty huff and shifted in his seat like the guy had a bad case of hemorrhoids.
I have to tell you, I was not entirely on board with this autopsy being performed here.
Why? I had to tread carefully with Lippincott. He was like a politician, in that the more questions you asked, the more diversion he inserted into his responses.
What makes her so special?
Another resigned exhale, and he tapped his finger against the rim of his glass.
She's been identified as one of the patients who went AWOL in your father's study.
Of course she was. Nearly 2 decades have passed since the scandalous disaster that had loomed over my career like a fucking curse. 6 women had died. 2 had gone missing, and somehow I'd inherited the shitshow job of cleaning up my father's reputation.
Well, it seems she can no longer speak about it.
So what's the problem?
The problem is, she broke into my house and tried to kill me. How incredibly fucked would that look if you then submit an autopsy report on a patient who went missing from a study 20 years ago, which demonstrates a rare parasite that I happen to have contributed a large sum of funds to research. She did accuse me of putting fucking worms in her belly.
Last I checked, all evidence of those women having participated in the study was eliminated.
It was sickening the way someone's entire life could be turned into a lie. How easily one's existence could be wiped out without question or explanation.
Every detail of the 2 who'd participated in the study and subsequently left had been thoroughly erased without a shred of consequence. While I'd been given all of my father's formulations, I knew nothing of the women involved in the study. It was probably better that way.
Reports were still submitted to the board prior to that. I don't need the media catching wind of this and conjuring stories that I had any part in this woman.